Welcome to Cloud Native Startup, where we explore what it takes to build a company in the open source cloud native ecosystem.
I'm Emily O'Meara, your host, and today I'm chatting with Matt Yonkovit, who is the head of open source strategy at Percona, otherwise known as the Haas at Percona. Matt, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Emily. I'm glad to be here.
I always like to start actually by digging in a little bit to people's job titles since we start with the introduction. People like to have their job title front and center, but what does it mean? So what does head of open source strategy mean?
So in the open source space, growing and connecting with the community is one of the most important activities that any open source project or company focusing on open source can do. And I get the opportunity and I have probably the funnest job at Percona. You know, there's a lot of fun jobs, but my job is helping to get users to do more and figure out all the cool things that they can do with not only our products, but other open source products. And so it's a bit of evangelism, a bit of community work, a bit of that open source program office role, all rolled into one. So I get to talk to a lot of fun people and do a lot of fun things.
Cool. And I'm actually always curious about this. What exactly, and for anyone who doesn't know Percona, can you introduce the company a little bit more and then also talk just a little bit more about how you make money?
Oh, no problem at all. So Percona was actually founded over 15 years ago now. This is our 15th anniversary. And we were founded from former MySQL AB employees. I worked at MySQL AB myself, and so did our co-founders, Peter Zaitsev and Vadim Tichinko. They decided that MySQL was getting a little too corporate for them. They were focused more on shareholder value and not necessarily on the user success or the open source community. And they felt that they wanted to spin off a company that helped keep the focus on the open source side of things. And so they founded Percona, first as a consulting company that focused solely on MySQL. But over the years, as we focused on helping customers get more scalable, secure, open source solutions, people asked us to do more. So we introduced support and services for MongoDB, as well as PostgreSQL, and we also do some MariaDB. So our focus has always been on the database side and on open source. And for us, how we make our money is we make money through services and subscriptions, almost a very Red Hat-like model, but focused exclusively on that database space.
Do you feel like you're able to, for lack of a better word, make money, be profitable without becoming too corporate?
So, like I said, we've been around for 15 years. We are very profitable, actually. In fact, we just had a record quarter. And so we are also 100% bootstrapped. So we've never taken outside funding. We have quite a wide customer base, thousands of customers worldwide with about a third of the Fortune 500 who have chosen Percona's solutions and software over upstream vendors or other database products.
Excellent. Actually, I'm glad to hear that you're bootstrapped, not because I have some sort of, prejudice against venture funding, not at all. But I don't know that many examples of bootstrapped companies in the space. And so every time I hear of one, it's interesting. And I didn't know that about Percona.
Yeah. And it's funny because it was that early time at MySQL that I think really impacted our leadership. And it was at a time when MySQL was starting to become that de facto standard in the LAMP stack. When MySQL decided to go, first they were trying to go IPO, but then they were also looking at potential acquisition, eventually getting acquired by Sun. Back then, Peter felt that focus on the shareholder value was driven more by those investors. So he shied away from any investors because he didn't want to dilute that kind of open source purpose. So it kind of fit with our purpose this whole time. And we've made a successful go at it for over 15 years. So it's always a positive.
Obviously, your open source strategy at a place like Percona is so core. I mean, there's even a part of me that's like, why is there a head of open source strategy? Isn't that like synonymous with like CEO?
Yeah, it is. And he does quite a bit in the community space. I augment a lot of what he does. So we work together. We've known each other for 15 years. But from a head of open source strategy perspective, like I said, I'm executing a lot of the processes from the community perspective. I'm doing a lot of outreach. Peter's still that visionary, and he gets to talk at a lot of shows, but I get to you know, help him do more. And I get to help other people within Percona explore how they can become those community rock stars, if you will, and become contributors out into not only the Percona space, but other spaces as well, because we want to contribute everything that we do upstream and keep that in that open space.
Do you think, when you think about open source strategy, do you think there are a couple of different formulas that people can follow?
Oh, that's a tough question. So it's interesting. So I gave a talk earlier this year at FOSDEM where I talked about what I called the death of openness and freedom. Open source was at risk because a lot of the models that you're seeing evolve are really kind of being impacted by larger dollar amounts coming into the ecosystem. So if you look at some of the larger companies that are out in the open source space that are publicly traded, they've started to change their licenses. They've started to become more protective of their practices, and they're doing it under the guise of, you know, hey, this is an, we're protecting our revenue from the cloud. But really what they're doing is they're focusing on, you know, how do they exceed shareholder value? How do they make more money? How do they improve their stock price? And sometimes that's at the cost of innovation and their user base. And that's becoming more of a de facto standard. And if you followed some of the changes, you know, let's say with Elastic recently in the last year, year and a half, where they changed to the SSPL, you see that movement to licenses that are not officially open source, but even more so, they have slight restrictions, right? So you can use this software as long as it's not on a Tuesday when the sun is up or on a Wednesday when you're eating soup. And I use that as an exaggeration, but there are some funny licenses and changes out there. And because of that, a lot of contributors in the open source space feel burned by contributing to some of these products and then not getting the expected outcome, if you will, which is a open source product that stays open and freely available so they can use it.
So personally, my take on this is that on the one hand, you want to sort of stay true to the mission. On the other hand, the people who contribute to open source projects ultimately are human beings who presumably have some like financial needs and, you know, like to have a roof over their head and eat and stuff like that. So I've always thought if open source is just something that's like a side project, that's not really sustainable. But then I also understand if it's just the same, if it's the same corporate feel as any other software, then what's the point? So how have you sort of found the middle road there?
Yeah. So, I mean, money is not bad. We all want money. We all want to make a salary. We all do this because, you know, we're in it for something. It's the intent and what you've set your business up as. And I think that where I've always had the line is I use proprietary software on a daily basis, right? I have like the Adobe suite and I have this at the other. And there's tons of software that I use that is not open source. I know some people who wouldn't use any non-open source software, but that's not where I fall. I think the bigger issue that I have is people trying to plug into the open source space with stuff that isn't open and pretending that it is and kind of fooling people into thinking that they're getting that open experience and all of the benefits of open source, but they're not really. And I think that is a key differentiator, right? As you move to the cloud, one of the big things about the cloud that has gotten a lot of press and a lot of companies rail against is, oh, you're moving there. And then it's really their own proprietary solutions because they don't give back to other open source companies and allow them to do their things, right? That's been a key issue that has been brought up against cloud providers. But a lot of vendors now in the database space and in other open source spaces are following suit and changing their strategies, their licenses, what you can, can't do to match what they're saying is bad about the cloud providers. And most of these companies aren't struggling mom and pop, you know, kind of, you know, startups, right? You know, you're talking about companies that are making $500 million or, you know, in some cases, even $1 billion. And you look at their financial numbers and yeah, they're making $1 billion, but they're spending $3 billion to make $1 billion. They're losing just tons of money. They're not profitable. Most of these companies aren't. And so a lot of this isn't about, oh, we're not making money. It's we're not making enough. And how do we chase that and, you know, in the database space, there's this thing called the eventual consistency model, where eventually your data will be consistent across all nodes. I like to call this the eventual profitability model that a lot of these companies follow, that eventually, someday, you know, profitability will show up. It's an interesting space there. And again, I'm not against vendors who have proprietary software. I just don't want people who are, especially new developers who are starting off in the open source space, to start looking at some of these as examples of, oh, when I develop the next application, I'm going to follow this model and think that it's open, because it really isn't.
Yeah, I really like that. It's not really about whether you're open or closed source. It's like, are you being honest? Are you being intellectually honest with your users and your customers and your users and with the overall community about what it is that you do? Just like you shouldn't lie about having a feature that you don't really do.
Yeah.
You don't really have. You shouldn't lie about being open source.
Yeah. And I have mad respect for, like, the MongoDB CEO came out and said, look, we didn't open source this to get any contributors. It's a marketing model for us. I mean, he flat out said that. And so you got to love when people own up to, yeah, we did this for this very specific reason. That's why we're not investing in these areas. And that's cool, right? I can admire that. You've been open and honest with us. You know where you stand. Cool. So I can appreciate all sides of this. I prefer the open source side. I prefer that more pure open innovation spirit. You're not going to get, you know, $1 trillion valuations typically from it, but in a lot of cases, you don't need that.
Yes. I do think one of the things that's often missed in the entrepreneurial world is that just because you are not a $1 trillion company doesn't mean you don't have boatloads of money.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I think that that is something that I've always been proud of working for Percona over the years, because we have kept true to our purpose, and we've had opportunities to make more money, but it would violate our values, and we chose not to.
So do you think that having an open source project just as a marketing play, what do you think about that strategy?
It's common, probably more common than I would like. I think that it is the freemium model to the extreme. It's a model that has been proven out time and time again with lots of different applications at different levels of scale, right? You probably have a dozen apps on your phone that follow a similar model, right? You know, that's just something that I think now inevitably we're having to deal with or live with. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I'm not going to post this as an extreme point of view, but I think it's bad when you don't understand the connotation or the implications of open sourcing something like that. And I think this is where you get into trouble and you see communities that get burned, right? So if you release software as a marketing strategy in the open source space and someone takes that software and makes it better and, you know, ends up reselling it, then that's a good outcome. It doesn't mean that you failed as a company. It means that, look, you know, you have successfully built something that other people can even monetize. And the problem comes in when, you know, that original company, their intent was, we're doing this to gain more market traction, to gain more revenue. And then all of a sudden, someone else starts to make revenue that they view as, hey, that should be my revenue. Quit stealing my revenue. That's where the problem comes in, right? And I think the philosophy we've always followed is, if more people use open source, if more people use open source databases, then we all benefit. Right? There's plenty of money out there. There's plenty of opportunity for people in the Postgres space, let's say, right? We can both compete and cooperate with other companies who are doing Postgres. It's a wonderful thing if we can take the Postgres market from $1 billion to $10 billion, because even if we have 10%, let's say, then we have 10% of a $10 billion market as opposed to a $1 billion market. So, you know, growing that traction doesn't have to be at the expense of others in the space. And if you have others in the space, that collaboration can mean so much. It can give you so many new opportunities, so much innovation, things that you might never have thought about doing. And so that's a real positive about the open source space.
You brought up this really interesting point about a company feeling like someone who's taken their open source code and then done something else with it and then monetized it feels like their revenue is being stolen. And I can sort of see that. On the other hand, it's also a reminder, right, that just having the technology isn't enough if you're talking about building a company or getting that revenue, monetizing it, you have to sell it. You have to, you know, have something that people want to pay money for, and you have to convince them that it is something they want to pay money for. It's not just enough to have some project that's awesome.
Absolutely. And I think Percona is in a unique position because a lot of the software we support is other open source software. So it is MongoDB, it is MySQL, it is Postgres, you know, and we have our own versions where we've done things to make them, you know, enhanced and put those out in the open source space. We've also built tooling, but largely we built Percona on the shoulders of giants. And, you know, that's something that is good for both us and them. And having more people who have more eyeballs is a positive thing. But what's interesting is because we've done that, we're not the sole owner of any one of those technologies. That means that every day we have to go out and prove ourselves and prove that we're good enough and that we're taking good enough care of the users and the customers to continually keep that business. Because one of our philosophies has always been, we want to make sure that we have compatibility with other open source, you know, versions, so we can keep that focus on the customer. Because if we're not good enough to satisfy the customer, then yeah, they should go somewhere else, right? We don't want to just, you know, lock them in and make them stay with us forever just because we own that one technology. We want you to choose us because we're better. And that changes your philosophy as you're building a project and as you're trying to monetize like open source. If your focus is on how do we keep on being better and servicing the customer better, it means that you're always putting that focus on what their needs are and how it's going to impact them, not necessarily how it's going to impact, you know, the stock price or shareholders or the people internally.
Oh, I have so many questions, but the first one I wanted to ask.
Ask questions. I mean, I'm an open book.
Who is a terrible customer for Percona?
So I think that a terrible customer for Percona, that's a tough one. I mean, there are no real terrible customers. You know, all customers are different. But I think that when you look at people who don't kind of fit the Percona mold, if you will, or aren't necessarily going to be successful with us, it's probably going to be more of the companies who are expecting everything to just be done, you know, magically behind the scenes without any sort of human interaction. You know, we have a lot of automation, but we pride ourselves on also having a human interface. And so we like to interact with people. We would like to talk with them. We like to give them the opportunity to use the features that they need. A lot of edge case features we don't put in our software. So we like to think of where we position our software is kind of in between what some of these enterprise versions are and where the community version is. We take a lot of enterprise features and we move them down to the open source space. So things like security or encryption or things that keep things, you know, secure and fast for customers. But there are some things that we might not integrate with, right? So, you know, we might not integrate with certain Windows LDAP solutions or something because our customers haven't wanted that and that hasn't been a focus and it's maybe too niche for us to focus on. So I think for us, where we look at the cloud native movement and some of the current movement, we're seeing a lot more handling things through Kubernetes, handling things through off-the-shelf kind of open source tooling, plugging in and integrating with other open source. And that plays really well to us because classically, we haven't done a ton of integration with big enterprise-y proprietary software. It's been more of the focus on the open source.
Yeah, that's interesting. So really for you, increasing adoption of open source is good.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. So the more people who use open source, the better we do, the better all the other companies in the space do. So, you know, hey, you know, wonderful. Great.
And it seems like on the flip side, a company who relies mostly on closed source is not the best fit.
Right. And I think that this is where it's interesting. Again, we like to try and be as transparent as possible, right? So we've told customers, hey, we're not a good fit for you. And a lot of that tends to be in a lot of bigger enterprises. There are expectations that come with certain pieces of software. There are certain migration projects that they're looking to do that they want to do very, very quickly, and they want to just have it as a black box. And quite honestly, one of the biggest concerns I see in the open source space is people trying to do these lift and shift migrations without actually thinking through the implications and designing that process. And companies that want to do that, there are tooling that's out there, but a lot of that tooling that exists only gets you so far. And there's a lot of extra development work and extra work you have to do to go beyond that. Databases are incredibly complex, and just saying, oh, I'm going to move from Oracle to MySQL or Oracle to Postgres doesn't mean that your application will still work. A lot of work has to be done in the application space. You have to redesign applications, rewrite them. And so you see that, you know, some companies go out there and they say like, oh, you know, like, you know, we want you to move from Oracle to MySQL or Postgres, and we've got this easy, handy to do tool that will do it in 5 seconds. And, you know, while it does work and it does help you, there's so much extra effort in there that it kind of fools people into that false sense. And, you know, a lot of times they'll come to us when they're in trouble because they're like, this isn't working as we expected. So there's this hand in hand nature of making sure that people understand that these databases and these open source technologies are great, but sometimes they fit a specific use case. And sometimes the proprietary solution is the best solution for you. And that's okay. We've always prided ourselves on trying to choose the best tool for the job, not necessarily try to make every job fit the one tool you have.
Yeah, this is something that I work with my clients on, being a little bit less afraid to say, this is the situation that we are the best for. And almost by definition, that means that here are some other situations that we are not the best for. And being less afraid, I suppose it's a lot easier when you don't have investors breathing down your neck. But
yes, of course, right? I think that changes a lot.
Yeah, you know, to be able to say that this isn't our solution is just not the right solution for your problem. You need to pound in a nail and I sell screwdrivers, so it's not the best.
But this is a trend that you see with larger companies, that the larger the company, the more they look at other technologies' user bases with envy. And so you start adding features and technology, which is outside of what your core background used to be, and you end up starting to potentially alienate or hurt that core audience. And this happens a lot with the database space. It's the MongoDB, MySQL, Postgres thing, right? So, oh, MongoDB does BSON, which can store JSON almost, you know, natively. Oh, we all need to do that. So we add that functionality. Oh, they do a document store. So let's add document store capabilities. And then MongoDB is like, oh, look, they're doing ACID, you know, OLTP transactions, you know, oh, we need to do that. And so you start to add these features into the technologies. And it's good if you need that niche, but it's sometimes questionable whether it was needed in the first place and how much actual additional market they gained from it.
And in fact, as you're mentioning, you can end up alienating your sort of core users.
Yeah.
Because the more features that you have, the more complicated your product. And sometimes people really just want an uncomplicated, they don't want to have to scroll to figure out the thing that they're going to use, right? They just want the features that they actually use, and the other stuff is just clutter.
Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, if you end up doing that and sort of trying to chase everyone else instead of just focusing in on your core, whatever your core use case is, it can really end up not being a good long-term strategy.
Right. I mean, I think that's the difficult proposition for a lot of companies is, how do you accelerate growth? How do you meet the expectations? And there's a few different ways, right? New product, new feature, change of pricing. And we see all those employed. And especially as you get bigger, as you cross that $100 million threshold, companies tend to start to make changes. And then as you cross the $300 million threshold, they make more changes. And then they continue to make changes as they chase those next kind of plateaus. And a lot of those changes, it's interesting. I did some looking and some research into this. You follow these big companies and you look at the turnover at the executive teams, and you take an open source company, and because you want to hit that next level, you kind of trick yourself into thinking like, okay, I need the next person to have grown to, you know, we're at 100 million. I need the next person to have grown to 500 million. So you go and you find somebody in a proprietary company, they come in and they go, oh yeah, you want to go to 500 million, then you need to make these changes and you need to stop doing the open source stuff the way that you were. And you see that continually happen over and over. And if you look at those public companies, the majority of them, like 95% of the executives, have little or no open source experience in their background, right? So these are the big publicly traded open source companies. They've pulled people from the Ciscos, from the Oracles, from the SAPs, right? These are big companies. And they come in and they have a philosophy of this is how I make money. And, you know, you make money with new products. You make money by locking things in and getting a net retention rate of 130% or what have you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would love your take on, you know, to what extent is an open source company different? Can you just put somebody in from a closed source background and expect that person to make good decisions, not just for the short term? So one of the things that struck me about this conversation is that throughout it, it sounds like Percona is playing the long game. And people like to talk about playing the long game, but actually doing it is really hard. It's really hard if you're running a business. It's really hard in your personal life. We would all have more retirement savings if this was easier to do. So it sounds like Percona is playing a long game.
Yeah.
Again, it's hard when you have investors that are like, I need a 3-year return on my investment or whatever. It's harder to play the long game. But to what extent can you expect somebody to come in with no background in open source or in open source businesses and be able to play a game that is both short term, but also a long game without losing sight of the long term goals?
It's interesting. So it is not impossible. It requires a very strong culture. The issue that a lot of companies face, and every company faces this in some form or another, every new hire you make changes the culture for better or worse. As you bring in new people, they're going to bring in their own expectations, their own preferences, their own way of doing things. And so you have to be incredibly prescriptive and protective of what is your core beliefs and what you will and won't do. And that is the most difficult thing. There could be some things that are the golden rules, the sacred cows at some companies, and there could be things that are not. And I think it's important to kind of identify what those are for your business. And as you grow, hey, you might have to shift focus and make changes. But if your core values, if your core vision is always consistent and protected, then those decisions are going to be guided by what those principles are, what that vision is. And I think that is something that a lot of companies don't necessarily protect as much, right? And I've seen this not just in open source companies, not just in companies that are in the startup space. I see this all the time with enterprise companies. I used to run our customer success and services team here at Percona. I was the chief customer officer for about 6 years. So I was in charge of renewals. I was in charge of making sure customers were happy, got what they needed. And when we lost a customer, we would dig into why. And one of the biggest reasons was they had turnover. And that turnover at the company was not even necessarily a manager. It could be technical people. It could be someone else. Because technical people who change, this one loves MySQL. This other one prefers Oracle. This one loves Postgres. This one prefers Mongo. And as they come in, those priorities change for them. And while that's a small technical change, and it's something that can impact renewal rates and people who are, you know, happy customers, you'll often see that on the management side, those changes are much more drastic. I can't tell you the number of startup companies that I know of that have executive teams that travel with them, right? And so maybe you've seen this and experienced this yourself where, you know, hey, you hire Joe from company X, they come in and they go, oh, well, I've got Kate from this company and, you know, she's worked with me before. I'm going to bring her in. And I know Bob from this company. I'm going to bring them in. And you end up bringing in almost entire organizations based on that one person's background. And that can help speed things up because obviously working together and knowing each other and what they expect can have some acceleration, but it also is dangerous from a culture perspective.
From hearing from other guests on the podcast, hiring executives, first of all, is really challenging. Second of all, fails very frequently. I had somebody say that if you have a 25% success rate for executive hires, you're above average. So that means every executive hire is a pretty big risk, especially because culture and all different manifestations depend so much on those people.
Yeah. And a lot of folks out there who make those hires. They're looking at the growth. They're looking at the potential. But a lot of folks need a certain environment to be successful in, right? So as you go hire someone who, let's say you're growing your customer success team or your sales team, there are certain executives in customer success who own expansion. Well, a lot of salespeople own expansion. So hiring one person who wants to own that and then, you know, a salesperson who wants to own that, it just breeds conflict, right? And that sets you up for issues. Same thing when you bring in, you know, new product people, when you bring in new engineering people, you can often set yourself up where from an organization perspective, you haven't thought through what your strategy and your plan is and what your go-to-market motions are. And because of that, you end up with maybe incompatible Lego pieces.
I want to shoot a sacred cow here for a minute.
Sure. I like shooting sacred cows.
I am curious what you think about growth in general. Now, in our culture, we always talk about growth as like a good thing. But do you get to a place where your business is profitable, you're making boatloads of money, you've got a successful open source project? I mean, do you need to grow? Can you just keep at that same level?
So let's quantify that a bit though, right? So there's different types of growth. And I think that ultimately, and I've talked to people about this because I've had this conversation with a few others, you know, especially people who have been on my teams in the past where they've come and they've said like, I don't understand why we're trying to grow. And it's like, well, you want to have more people who like are working on that project, right? Well, how do I pay for them? You know, you want to get a raise this year, don't you? You know, so there's certain amount of growth that is baked into every company, whether you are a quote unquote lifestyle company or a hyper growth company. And I think that whether that's a 10% growth every year, 20%, 30% growth every year, there is moderate growth and you can make a very sustainable, successful business out of that sort of growth. And there's nothing wrong with that. Hyper growth, on the other hand, you know, where you're talking about we're going to triple in a year or 3 years or whatever, that tends to be a bit more challenging and produces some negative outcomes. There aren't a lot of companies that can sustain that growth without their cost of acquisition being way too high. I mentioned a lot of the companies that are out in the open source space that are publicly traded. They have a lot of growth, but they're doing it at a cost of 2 to 3x acquisition cost, right? So it's a really expensive growth. So you can get the growth. And if your goal is to potentially improve your market valuation, to improve what the value of the company is, you can do it that way. I'm afraid at some point in the future, though, people are going to realize it's an unsustainable model and then things are going to go, you know, sideways. But I don't think you need hyper growth to be successful. I do think you need some growth. I think that if you have a stagnant company that isn't growing at all, eventually attrition will come back and bite you because you want to continue to invest and create new opportunities for your users, if you will. And sometimes that's just making the product better, making it more efficient, adding it to new products, maybe adding language support. I mean, it could be minor things, but those incremental improvements can matter quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think there is a good distinction to make between hyper growth and just sort of normal
growth. Yeah, I mean, you know, I put my money in a bank account, I put it in stock, I get whatever return, you know, I would expect that, you know, a lot of other companies can get a little better returns, but that doesn't mean it's hyper. And I think we are fixated on that hyper growth as an industry and especially investors, right? I mean, that's how they make their money. Let's be honest. When you're talking about investor-led growth, you're talking about coming in, giving somebody some money and expecting a big return on that investment in, you know, 3 to 5 years.
Yep. And usually that doesn't give you, which can have long-term consequences.
Yeah. And I think this gets back to one thing that I have also preached quite a bit. Open source is not a business model. And that is an important distinction, right? Open source was never designed as a business model. There are business models that make use of open source. But when I hear somebody say like, oh, you need to open source this so you can make more money, that makes me cringe because open source was never designed for that. Open source has more in common with social movements and with kind of the freedom and loving side of the industry than it does with money-making operations.
I believe that's sometimes called open source hippies.
Yeah. Well, hey, I'm an open source hippie. Proud to be it. But no, it's funny because I think that there's a lot of love in the open source space, but even like the investors, and I've read quite a few papers that investors have written, they've said open source is not a business model either. It's just a marketing tool. And I think that's how a lot of investors approach it. But a lot of founders and executive teams believe, hey, if I build it, then people will come. And then they start to question why they're not coming, right? And if you build it, is no guarantee that people are going to come.
Yeah. My personal take on that is that open source is sort of a marketing tool, but I think not exactly in the way that a lot of founders think. It's not a lead funnel. It's not, you know, you don't expect to like convert your open source customers. You certainly don't want to like market directly to them because that'll just, I shouldn't even say open source customers. Did I just say that?
Yeah, but it's funny.
See, I totally misspoke, but people do think about it like that.
Oh, they do. Oh my gosh. I've talked to so many founders or execs who, especially on the community side, where they view community as the main purpose is pushing people along the funnel. And I think that that is one of the biggest issues that you see in the startup space, you know, when it comes to open source is, hey, adoption does not mean dollars.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, you can totally have agree. An insanely successful project that is insanely unprofitable.
Yeah. And that's a very common struggle. And I think it comes from, I mean, my take on it is it comes from not really understanding who the user is versus who the customer is, and that there's going to be some overlap, but it's not usually nearly as much as people expect.
Right.
Well, Matt, this has been fabulous. Anything else that you want to add before we wrap up?
No, like I said, open book, happy to talk about anything, anytime. Feel free to reach out.
How should listeners reach out to you if they want to?
So I'm on Twitter at mjankovits. You can come to percona.community. That's our community homepage. You can also check out the Haas Talks Foss podcast if you're interested in me talking with all kinds of crazy database folks and open source folks out there. Talk with CTOs, CEOs, everything in between, and even architects, developers. Always interested to hear what people have going on in the open source space.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me. This was a fabulous conversation.
All right. I appreciate it. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Cloud Native Startup. If you'd like to learn more about positioning, messaging, and go-to-market for open source and cloud native startups, head over to my blog, positioningopensource.com. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Emily O'Meara, and you can feel free to reach out on Twitter or on my website and blog with questions or comments. If you enjoyed this episode, also please share and help more people discover this podcast. Thank you, and we hope to have you next week.